From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The academic Tim Burkett is like most of the rest of us. He thinks it's cool that birds can fly. But really, he's more interested in the other biological gifts of the species. Birds, we know, have amazing sight and hearing. And Burkett says we identify closely with them because we also rely on those senses. But with birds, there's so much more. They have an incredibly complicated sense of smell and taste and touch. Burkett says they possess a magnetic map, like a GPS system, says they even express emotion. Today in the program, Tim Burkett is joining us to talk about what it's like to be a bird. That is, what it means to have bird sense. We invite you to join us after this news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In his new book, the academic Tim Burkett writes a story about how we came to know what we know about birds. And not just the flight part, but about their extraordinary senses of sight and hearing and taste and touch. Burkett says that we're even learning things that suggest they have emotional lives. He says the book is about how birds perceive the world, and it's based on a lifetime of ornithological research, but also this conviction that he has that for some reason we have consistently underestimated what goes on in a bird's head. The book is called Bird Sense, What It's Like to Be a Bird. And Tim Burkett is joining us today to talk about it. We invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is our number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'd also like to hear from those of you on Facebook and on Twitter. Tim Burkett is a professor of animal behavior and science history at the University of Sheffield in England. His writing has appeared in numerous magazines and newspapers. His books include The Cambridge Encyclopedia of Ornithology and The Wisdom of Birds. He's joining us today from the studios of the BBC in Sheffield, England. And Tim Burkett, welcome. Thanks for being
Hello.
With us.
Hello. Hi.
I wanted to start with what I guess is kind of the initial insight that got you thinking about the book and thinking about writing the book, and that is this experience you had with the guillemots, kind of an extraordinary experience. I wanted you to start with that story.
Sure. Okay. My PhD was on the study of guillemots, the population biology of guillemots. You call them MERS in North America, and these are highly social birds that breed on sea cliffs. And I had some fairly clear goals for my study. I was interested in their ecology and behavior. And to watch the birds and to record information, I built a hide in a crack in the cliffs. And I was in this particular hide, I was incredibly close to the birds, just about a meter away. And it was fantastic because it felt as though I was actually part of the colony. Hmm. And I used to go there. It was a long hands and knees crawl to get in there, but it was well worth it. And on one occasion, I was watching the birds when a bird that was incubating its egg right in front of me suddenly stood up and started to give its greeting call. And I thought to myself, that's very odd, because normally that greeting call isn't given unless the partner's present. And so I looked out to see through my binoculars, and there was lots of birds flying backwards and forwards, but I could see one bird probably 500 to 700 meters away flying towards the cliffs. And to my absolute disbelief, this bird landed beside the bird that had just stood up and given the greeting call. So this bird that gave the greeting call had seen and recognized its partner when that partner was nothing more than a speck. Now, I'm watching guillemots at a meter's distance, and they all look pretty much the same to me. This bird could recognize its partner at that distance. And suddenly, the world and thinking about guillemots completely changed me. My whole perception of them was changed in that one act. It was absolutely remarkable.
What was changed? What was it that you realized, I don't know how that works?
Yes, exactly. I mean, first of all, clearly they had incredible vision, much, much better vision than we have. And the fact that I can't tell the difference between guillemots, but there's something about them, that they allows them to recognize their partner. The other thing that was kind of deeply shocking was that as a behavioral ecologist interested in behavior and ecology of the birds, there was nowhere to put that bit of information. It just didn't fit into the behavioral ecology paradigm. And I thought that that was a bit frustrating. So I kind of just filed it away at the back of my mind. And so, you know, 30 or 40 years on, that pops out and becomes the iconic moment, really, for me starting to write Bird Sense.
You talk about in the book how this attitude about the study of senses in humans to some degree, I suppose, but also in animals, had this kind of checkered history that people really avoided the subject for years and years. What do you think that was about?
Well, lots of scientific subjects come and go, and you know, some of them have their day. Luckily for me, behavioral ecology has had a long day. It started in the mid-1970s. It's still going strong. But the subject of sensory biology of birds has had a much shorter and much more, as you say, more checkered life. So that it was popular in a very small way in the 1970s when there were a small number of people looking at scent and sight and hearing and so on. And then all that kind of standard physiology was eclipsed by the molecular revolution, and suddenly it wasn't very trendy to look at those rather basic sensory facilities that birds have, and so the subject area kind of went out of favour. And for me, one of the most telling things that happened while I was writing this book, I went back through the literature, and there are one or two wonderful handbooks about the sensory biology of birds, and I identified somebody who'd done some fantastic stuff on touch and taste, and I managed to track him down. And he was retired. He'd been retired for a few years. And after a few conversations, he said, you know, I just don't believe this is happening. I studied this stuff all my career. Nobody was very interested. I retire 2 years ago and you come along and then start asking me all these really interesting questions. And so that for me, you know, that was very poignant. But this guy subsequently became a really good friend and he advised me and we had really great conversations. And it made me realize that in a way, it's rather sad when subjects go out of favor. And I think what it was from my own perspective was that adding a kind of behavioral and ecological slant to sensory biology suddenly made it come alive in a way that wasn't there 20 or 30 years ago.
You have said you started watching birds at the age of five. You're encouraged by your father to be a bird watcher. Did it catch on right away? Have you always been interested in birds?
I guess right from the start, as soon as I kind of discovered birds, I became a bit obsessive, you know, a bit of a nerd about these things. But one of the most telling incidents in my childhood, we were on holiday in North Wales, and I was about 11, and my father took me to a seabird island called Bardsey Island. It's actually one of the most beautiful islands off the coast of Britain. And as we walked back after a wonderful day of bright blue skies and wheeling seabirds, we saw a chap on the cliffs with a telescope. He was sitting down and had a notebook. And as we passed by, my dad just casually said, you know, you could do something like that when you're a bit older. And wow, that idea stuck. You know, literally, that's what I've spent most of my life doing ever since.
Can you put a finger on it? What is it about watching a bird and studying a bird and, you know, understanding them? What is it about that that you love so much?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Birds are just, you know, very beautiful. They're very accessible. You know, we can see, most birds are kind of diurnal, so we can see them. And there's just lots and lots of stuff we don't know about them. So being a scientist, I'm intrigued by the challenges that birds and other organisms pose. But you do have to like your study organism, and I've always been very keen on birds.
It's interesting. You've talked about in the past how a lot of our early knowledge of birds, you know, came from people who kept birds, which it's considered really not a... I don't know if it's still considered that way, but it came to be considered something that you just didn't do. You didn't keep birds. So there's this kind of distance. But it seems like you like the connection in some way to birds.
No, I think that's absolutely fascinating. I mean, definitely the ornithology got its beginnings in people keeping birds, mainly for their song, sometimes for their appearance. And then over time, as you said, it became unfashionable to keep birds. People thought it was cruel. I don't think it really is cruel if it's a bird that's been bred in captivity. But because it became unfashionable, people kind of just obliterated that from their memory. So the idea that bird keeping might have contributed to ornithology was just a no-go area. And so about 10, 15 years ago, I started to look at some of the very old bird keeping books from the 1500s and 1600s. And I realized that nobody had ever read these things. You know, they'd looked at the pictures, but nobody had read what these people, sometimes very perceptive people, had noticed and written down. And so that there was a wide open field for me with all this amazing historical stuff that filtered, you know, directly into our current understanding of birds.
The history part really interests you, doesn't it? I mean, you really, I mean, you've written about Frederick II, for example, this passionate falconer who came to, I mean, you really like the history part as it connects to the story.
Yeah, I hated history at school. I wasn't very good at it. But, you know, when you find a focus and looking at the way people come to understand birds, history suddenly becomes, you know, incredibly important. And I think what I'm interested in probably more than the history is just the development and the evolution of ideas. How did we get to our current state of understanding? If you're a non-scientist, you kind of accept the facts that appear on TV shows about wildlife as though, you know, that was always known. But often discovering how migration works or something like that has been an incredible struggle with lots of blind alleys and people working very hard, sometimes being right, sometimes being wrong. So I'm interested in that whole endeavor of discovery.
There's a great story you tell about this time. I'm not sure if you're still obsessed with old books, but you had this moment where you're really caught up in these old books and you had a friend go to this auction for you and you came back with this French book that you had a grad student of yours or something to help you translate, but it turned out to be an incredibly important book about sort of, I think you've described it as the turning point of history of ornithology.
Okay, and by a funny coincidence, I've been working on that today, writing a paper about that very book. So as I became more and more interested, if you wanted to get into these old books, you either had to go to some of the big university libraries like Oxford or Cambridge, and that meant a day's travel, and then always a frustratingly short period of time. And then, of course, Amazon comes along and, you know, do you want to buy this with one click? And it's suddenly very tempting. And so, you know, I started accumulating books. And then once people knew I was interested in books, a colleague said, oh, there's a big sale of old bird books coming up in Germany. You know, is there anything you want? He sent me the catalogue, and the prices ranged from, you know, a few hundred pounds to tens of thousands of pounds. So I very tentatively identified a small number of very cheap books and then completely forgot about it. Mm. 6 months later, a package arrived, and I was thinking, gosh, what is this? And I opened it up, and then slowly I remembered what had happened. And I went through the books, and oh, yes, I remember ordering that one. I remember ordering that one. And then suddenly there's this book at the bottom. It's called Traite du Rossignol, Treatise on a Nightingale. I thought, didn't order that one. And it wasn't terribly expensive. And it was in French. And luckily I had a French-speaking graduate student. And I just said, just tell me what's in here. And she started to go through it. And suddenly I had this amazing realization that I'd struck gold. The key finding in this book was something to do with migration. And that, it's a behavior that birds, migratory birds in captivity show. And it's generally called by its German name, Zugunruhe. And basically what that is, if you have a small bird in a cage at the time it would normally be migrating, the little bird is hopping about, whirring its wings. Basically, it's migrating on the spot. Now, the term Zugunruhe implies that this behavior was discovered by a German ornithologist and a guy called Naumann in the 1790s is usually credited with that discovery. But here in front of me was this French book 100 years earlier, and it was clear that this anonymous French guy, he had discovered it. And what we've just discovered in the last couple of weeks is, first of all, we've discovered who he is. He's a guy called Nicholas Vanette. And he was very famous for something a long way from birds. He wrote basically a sex manual. And this was incredibly popular, 140 editions. It's amazing that nobody kind of put two and two together and realized that this was the same guy that had written the Nightingale book. But I guess if you've written a very popular book on another subject, you know, that eclipses anything to do with birds. So we've discovered who he is, and we've verified that indeed he was the first person to recognize this. And, you know, if you look at the way he's made his observations, constructed his argument, he was basically a pioneer. And this is 1697 when this was going on. Absolutely fantastic.
Well, we'll come back to the idea of migration when we get to this magnetic sense. But what did you come up with the title for the book, this idea of, you know, what it's like to be a bird?
Okay, I was interested in the senses of birds. I was interested in the fact that we'd underestimated the senses of birds. And then, you know, when you're thinking about a book, you know, you turn lots of different ideas over in your head, you know, day and night, and then one day you wake up and you go, oh, bird sense, what it's like to be a bird. And I think that's the key. What is it like to be a bird? And of course, that relates to this famous essay by a guy called Nagel, who was a philosopher, who basically claimed that we can never know what it's like to be another person, let alone another organism. And he wrote a famous essay called What It's Like to Be a Bat. And he chose bats because, like us, they're mammals, but unlike us, they have senses, basically echolocation, that we don't have. So he thought this would be a poignant example of how we could never know what those other senses are. Now, as I say in the book, I think Nagel was rather pessimistic in suggesting that we can never know anything about what it's like to be another organism. And in fact, biologists now have a wide array of tools that give them quite a good window into what it must be like to be a bird. Of course, we don't know exactly what it's like to be a bird, but we have a much, much better idea than he ever supposed back in the 1970s when he wrote that essay.
Well, you had a conversation with your mother. I think you were 10. She said the same thing. How can you know what they're seeing or what they're feeling?
That's right. I'd read somewhere that dogs, and we always had a pet dog, you know, dogs only see in black and white. And I told my mum this, and she was completely disparaging. She's still alive. You know, I'm gonna harass about this when I see her next week. And she said, "Don't be ridiculous. How can people possibly know what it's like to what a dog can see?" She said, "They can't see through a dog's eyes." And in fact, we can effectively do that now. We can see through a dog's eyes. We can see through a bird's eyes. And we have a very good idea of the kind of things that you can see. And of course, the other thing my dear old mum didn't realise was that you can actually devise an incredibly simple behavioural test to see whether a dog can see in colour or not. And, you know, of course, people have done that on numerous occasions and confirms that they can't.
When you're talking about seeing, the sense of seeing, sight, you write about how, as you were reading about the eyesight of birds, that this particular phrase kept coming up. A wing guided by an eye. And you said you kept seeing it, and it really irritated you.
Yeah, there's always kind of a lot of plagiarism to some extent, certainly in the older literature. And this particular phrase, a wing guided by an eye, just kept coming up every time anybody wrote an account of the senses of birds. And what that did for me was to say, birds have great vision, which is, of course, absolutely true, but it also said they don't really have much else either. You know, it's just an eye with wings. And it kind of underestimated all these other senses. So part of my motivation for writing the book was to try and redress the balance and make people realize that birds are a lot more than just a wing guided by an eye.
I wanted to ask you about something I hadn't realized. I mean, there's so many things that you write about related to sight. One thing I hadn't realized is that birds use their right and left eyes for different tasks.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
It's called lateralization, which just means sidedness. And it's kind of been known for quite a long time. But if you just think about the majority of birds have their eyes placed on the sides of their head. So they don't really have binocular vision in the same way that we do. Of course, owls do, but they're in a minority. Yeah. So in one sense, it's not too difficult to imagine that they might see two separate images on each side of the head. But what's become apparent recently is that, as you say, birds use their right and left eye for different purposes. So day-old chicks of the domestic hen use one eye for looking for food, and the other eye keep literally being open for predators flying above. And this kind of lateralization, differential use of the eye, seems to be incredibly widespread. It hasn't been really studied in a huge amount of detail, but lots of people have noticed these biases towards right or left eye. And one of the interesting things is that if a bird has a bias towards, let's say, the right eye for doing a certain task, if you try to force it to use the other eye to do that task, it's much less good at it. So it looks as though there's some kind of brain training going on. I think for me, the most remarkable bit of biology that's linked to that was the discovery of whether that lateralization was genetic or environmental.
Yeah.
And my intuition would have said, of course, it's just genetic. But it turns out to be environmental, and it was discovered in the most wonderful way. So Leslie Rogers, the lady biologist who did this work, realized that when the chick was developing inside the egg, that one of its eyes faced inwards and would not see any light because it was looking into the black body mass. Mm. But the other eye, facing out towards the shell, would get some light coming through the eggshell. And she reckoned that maybe that light trained one eye to be the eye that did one set of tasks and the other set of tasks. So what she did was to open some eggs just before they hatched, and very gently, without hurting the chicks, she turned the head round. And when she did that, the other eye became the eye that would normally be the one that was exposed to light and doing a particular task. So a very elegant and simple demonstration that this lateralization is environmentally controlled.
You're right about how black-winged styles, I'm not sure.
Stilt.
How they direct courtship displays with their left eye, and how a peregrine falcon mainly uses its right eye. Is it like humans who are left or right-handed? Is it something like that?
Yes, it's exactly like that. And it's clearly, it's clearly linked to which half of your brain is functioning. So with us, you know, if we do something with our right eye, it's the left side of the brain that's controlling it. And exactly the same thing is true of birds. And my guess is, as I say, we haven't really studied this in a lot of detail, but the more people look, I suspect, the more of this lateralization that we'll see. And you talk about humans being right or left-handed, and of course, birds like parrots, which use their feet to manipulate food, they are very definitely right or left-handed.
You may have known this, and ornithologists may have known this, but I didn't realize some birds can sleep while still looking at the world with one eye open. And I loved how you say Chaucer even sort of noticed this.
Isn't that amazing? Yes. I think that if you were watching, say, ducks by the side of a pond, they clearly have one eye open a lot of the time and the other eye closed.
Yeah.
And, for us, going to bed and being safe in our houses, we can close both our eyes and be fairly confident we're not going to be eaten by a predator. But if you're a bird sleeping either on the side of a pond like a duck or in a tree, you just can't go to sleep for 8 hours and keep your fingers crossed and hope that everything's going to be fine. So patterns of sleep in lots of different animals are very different from the 6 or 8 hours that we typically have. And lots of birds sleep in short bouts. And as I say in the book, sometimes they can sleep with one half of the brain at one time and then the other half at another time.
Mm. And there are birds that sleep while flying.
Apparently. Having written that, a number of people have quizzed me about that. And to absolutely verify that, you'd have to have something that was recording traces from the brain to know about whether you've got rapid eye movement or something like that going on, the equivalent of that, to be sure that the bird is actually asleep. It's actually very hard to verify that the bird really is asleep.
In the book, you try and imagine what it's like for birds who have incredibly, rapid flight, like a hummingbird, for example. And you're trying to figure out how they process this information so quickly. And you say the closest we can get to that sensation is a near-death experience.
Well, as someone that's done a lot of field work and had quite a few narrow escapes during field work, I had one or two near-death experiences.
Yeah.
And when people jokingly say, your life passes before your eyes, well, it's absolutely true. I've been in some tight spots, and that's exactly what happens. And I think that that's just one way you might visualize the way a bird might deal with this business of having to respond incredibly rapidly. Things, in a few seconds as a human, you can experience what seems like not quite a lifetime of memories, but a lot of memories. And I think birds are reacting very quickly to all sorts of stimuli, and things just are processed in their brain very, very rapidly.
Mm. Tim Burkhead is with us. His book is called Bird Sense, What It's Like to Be a Bird. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. ¶¶ This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the academic Tim Burkhead. He is with us to explain what it's like to be a bird, not just the flight stuff, but how they have unbelievable senses of sight and hearing and taste and touch. Burkhead says they even have emotion. This book is called Bird Sense, What It's Like to Be a Bird. And you can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. So let's talk about hearing. You say we don't know as much about avian hearing as we do about avian sight.
That's absolutely true. It's rather odd if you think about it. Birds do a huge amount of their communication by song or calls. So you'd have imagined that people would have been very keen to understand how well or how badly a bird hears. And although people have focused on those songs and calls, they focus much less on the actual process of hearing. So it's very odd that that happens.
Mm. They have, you write about, they have very, of course, I guess this makes sense, particular needs when it comes to the hearing. They have to kind of detect, you know, predators. They have to identify their own kind. They have to find food. And they have, you say, they have to be able to identify where a particular sound is coming from and then distinguish, you know, from the background noise. So how does, do we know how the structure of their ear works? Is it different among species that are types?
The bird's ear is basically similar to ours. We have three bones in the middle ear, but birds only have one. But that's due to their reptilian ancestry. Reptiles have the same, but it seems to work pretty well. Mm. And then the inner ear with the semicircular canals, which are there to control balance, are pretty much the same as ours. And then the kind of business bit of the ear, that's called the cochlea, cochlea because it looks like a snail in mammals, is actually banana-shaped in birds. And about 100 years ago, somebody, one of the pioneers really in avian hearing, decided to just look at this structure, the cochlea. And it's actually a very difficult structure to look at because, like ours, it's embedded in the bone in the skull. So you'd have to be very determined to dissect it out. But he noticed that in some species it was quite short. And in owls, which are renowned for having fantastic hearing, it is enormous. And that was the first kind of bit of comparative evidence that the quality of hearing, the sensitivity of hearing might differ dramatically between birds. And of course, the whole business of owls having fantastic hearing is remarkable. And when I was doing the research for this book, was actually one of the absolute high spots. So it's quite well known amongst ornithologists that the ears of owls, even though you can't see birds' ears, they're hidden behind the feathers, are placed asymmetrically on the skull. And I was very keen to see this. It's very strange. You know, I'd read all this and I was thinking, here I am. I'm an ornithologist. I've been doing this for 35 years. I've never had an opportunity to look at this. And I knew somebody that had some great grey owls. Mm. So I drove down there and she very kindly caught them out of her aviary. And they're huge. You know, it's like having a huge baby in your arms, except you have to hold on to the feet because of very strong claws. And then I very gently lifted the feathers around the facial disc of the owl so I could see the ears. And I was just blown away by both the beauty and the complexity of the structure. When I say beauty, you take that with a pinch of salt. It was a bit like a grubby human ear. Right. But it was very complicated, you know, with flaps and little bits of skin and an amazing array of feathers around the edge. So at the bottom, the feathers have these big, broad bases, and then they become very fine at the top. And then at the back of the ear, the feathers are very, very dense, presumably to stop the sound going past them and pushing it down the ear opening. And then, of course, when I looked at the position of the two ears, on one side, it was at the equivalent of 7 o'clock, and on the other side of the head, it was the equivalent of 2 o'clock. So phenomenal asymmetry. And, of course, that asymmetry has evolved so that the sound that the owl is listening to reaches those two ears at very slightly different times. For us, because we've got quite big heads, sound reaches our two ears slightly different times anyway. That allows us to pinpoint sound. But if you're a bird, the way you do that is by having asymmetrical ears. If you're an owl, where you have to rely on hearing, And of course, the other thing about owls, the reason their eyes point forward is nothing really to do with binocular vision. It's simply to allow this huge facial disc, which is a sound capture device, to maximize the amount of sound that they come in, have coming into their ears.
It can pinpoint a mouse, you say, underneath the snow.
Absolutely. So you can go onto YouTube or something and look at Great Grey Owl, and they sit there on a perch listening, turning their head this way and that way. Once they've got it pinpointed the location, they just plunge, they fly, plunge through the snow and capture the mouth. That is pretty sophisticated hearing.
Mm. 801-585 West is the number to join us. Let's go to the phones. Michael is with us in Salt Lake. Michael, welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
So I was hoping we could revisit for just a second the analogy between a near-death experience and flying for birds. I thought what was interesting about the analogy was perhaps also something that was dangerous about that analogy, in that it maybe conflates this muscle memory thing that's going on with birds with what we as humans have, this sort of super cognitive store of memories. It's a very highly emotional thing that happens in a near-death experience. And we might risk anthropomorphizing birds a little bit if we start to imagine what they're going through in flight as something so super cognitive rather than something that's super athletic, let's say, or so muscular, a very finely tuned athlete type scenario.
It's a pretty sensible concern, Tim Burkhead. You hear it all the time. I'm especially related to this idea of bird emotion. You want to respond to that?
Yeah, I'm acutely aware that I don't want to anthropomorphize at all. And I simply use that example as something where a lot of information passed through our head in a very short space of time as a kind of an analogy for birds being able to process information very quickly so that they can fly around like a hummingbird in dense vegetation or fly around in a dense flock in a flock of blackbirds without crashing into each other. I agree that it's very unlikely that when a bird's flying, it's going to have a whole jumble of emotions passing through its head like that. It was simply as a way of trying to visualize compressing time, a lot of stuff into a short space of time. I'm very aware of not anthropomorphizing as a scientist.
Mm. But how then do you talk about the idea of, which you do in the book, we may as well get to it now, the idea of emotion and whether a bird has an emotional life or expresses a kind of emotion?
Yeah, this is the $64,000 question. Yeah. This is the hardest chapter to write, partly because scientists have steered so clear of this topic. You know, they're terrified of being accused of being anthropomorphic. Yeah. So it's been a no-go area. But as I say in the book, I think the study of animal behavior now is old enough and mature enough to start thinking about these things in a sensible way. Now, that's not to say that studying these areas would be incredibly difficult. Yeah. But the way I tried to deal with it is the same way that Darwin dealt with it. Imagine that there's a continuum with pleasure at one end and displeasure or pain at another. And those people that argue that birds have no emotion also argue that they can't feel pain or pleasure. I describe one particular example which involved, it's now illegal, but when farmers de-beaked chickens to stop them pecking at each other, the evidence that those birds, after they'd had the ends of their beaks removed, that they felt pain, for me, was absolutely unequivocal. There was really good behavioural evidence. There was good neurological evidence. If birds can feel pain, there's absolutely no reason why they can't feel the opposite, some kind of pleasure. Now, of course, it's going to be very difficult for us to imagine what that pleasure feels like. But again, there's lots of behavioural evidence that I would argue suggests that sensation of pleasure is there. So the guillemots that I've spent 40 years watching, one of the things that they spend a lot of time doing is preening their partners. We call it allopreening. But yeah, guillemots also allopreen their neighbours. They're basically forming relationships. And you can see time and time again, a bird is preening another one, then it stops. The bird that has been preened will nuzzle up to the other one as though to say, come on, I'd like some more of that. Mm. And the best, you know, comparison is if you have a pet dog and you're fondling its ears or whatever and you stop, it'll just nuzzle up to you and do exactly the same thing. And again, at the risk of sounding anthropomorphic, we are in no doubt that our dog finds that a pleasurable experience. We're actually in no doubt that we find that a pleasurable experience, grooming the dog. So I don't really see that there's any reason why a bird shouldn't experience some kind of pleasure. And as I say, the behavioural evidence suggests that they do.
You tell the story about a zebra finch you used to have, blind zebra finch, who had a deep affection for your daughter.
Yes. So a lot of my research on reproduction in birds is done on zebra finches. And many years ago, we hatched a bird that turned out to be blind right from birth. And my daughter volunteered to take it home and hand-rear it and look after it. And Billy, as he became known, became a very popular family pet for about 6 years. And he lived in a cage on the landing in the house. And I wish now I'd spent more time studying him, because he was a real window into what's going on to a bird's mind. First of all, my daughter, who handwritten him, she's an identical twin. This bird could tell the difference between her footstep and her sister's footstep. And so when he heard Laurie, my daughter, he would burst into song. If it was the other daughter coming along the corridor, he just ignored it. And so, yeah, I thought, gosh, he's very perceptive. And he also enjoyed being alloprene very much. And my daughter had small hands, and she was very adept at it because zebra finch is very small. I was less adept at it. And when I alloprened him, it was a mixture of pain and pleasure, because if I got it right, he would close his eyes and turn his head to one side and just look as though he was enjoying it. But if I was a bit clumsy and bumped his head, he'd turn around and peck me as though to say, come on, do this properly.
Michael, thanks. 801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Let's go back to the phones. Sally is with us. Sally, hi.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
Sure.
I've raised ducks for 15 years. My flock got as large as 42. Okay. It's down to 6 right now. And I have studied intensely my ducks for the last 15 years, and I don't know if Tim has come upon this with his favorite type of bird, but there are behavioral rules that they follow and roles that they follow. The head of my flock is named Hero. He's a very large American Peking. He will never eat food with the rest of the ducks. When they go for the gusto, when their food's brought out, he stands very tall and scans for danger.
Tim Burkhead, does this make sense? Is the kind of social order among groups?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the most striking things about this person's observation is having had the time to watch these birds in detail. You just gain this greater insight into what makes them tick. Of course, things like dominance hierarchies, where one bird assumes a dominant role, is quite widespread in birds, and ducks are no different from a lot of other birds in that respect.
Sally, thanks. 801-585-WEST is the number. Tim Burkhead is with us. His book is called Bird Sense, What It's Like to Be a Bird. We need to take another break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Tim Burkhead. We're talking about his book, Bird Sense, What It's Like to Be a Bird. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. I want to talk about the sense of taste, because you write that this debate of whether a bird has a sense of taste has been going on a long, long time. Sally mentioned ducks. It's extraordinary what kind of remarkable sense of taste a duck has.
I think people imagine that birds have no sense of taste or smell, partly because birds don't have any facial expression. Mm. If we eat something that we like or drink something that we like, you know, we smile, you can see the facial expression, you can see the immediate association between eating and, you know, some kind of sensation. But because birds have a beak, you know, it doesn't give anything away.
Yeah.
And so that, you know, it's easy to imagine that there's absolutely nothing going on. But, you know, a bird's beak is just this unbelievably complex, sensitive structure. It looks as though it's hard. And the analogy I draw in the book is that, you know, our hands are fabulously sensitive as well, but only on the inside and the fingertips, you know, but we can also turn our hand into a fist, which makes it very hard. So you can't, it's not a contradiction. You can have those two things happening at the same time. And birds have both fantastic sense of touch inside their beak, but also a sense of taste. Part of the reason people assumed that birds had no sense of taste was that they just made this naive assumption that the taste buds would be on the tongue.
Yeah.
And when they started to dissect birds and look for taste buds on the tongue, they couldn't find any. So, very obvious, birds have no sense of taste. It wasn't until somebody said, well, hang on, let's just see if they have any taste buds anywhere else in their mouth, that they discovered that the taste buds are distributed in a completely different way from they are in the way they are in humans. And then, again, behavioural experiments showed very clearly that birds had a good sense of taste. I think that the example I like best is in ducks. They're dabbling around in the mud with their beak. Their eyes are on the side of the head, so they can't even see the end of their beak. So they're relying entirely on the sense organs in the beak, touch and taste. And some very nice experiments done by a Dutch colleague of mine showed that if you mixed peas, which they like to eat, with mud, the duck can dabble around in the mud and pick the peas out. Mm. And the way the bird eats the pea is in a very kind of structured kind of way. So it picks it up in the tip of the beak where there are both touch and taste receptors, and it uses those to recognise that this is something that's edible. And then it flips the pea back a few centimetres to another area inside the mouth which is rich in touch and taste receptors. So there's a second filter mechanism, if you like, to decide whether this is going to go down the throat or not. Mm. And then further back, there's actually at the beginning of the throat, there's the same thing again. So the bird has got three ways of checking whether what they've picked up is something that's worth eating.
Mm.
And, you know, that's just makes common sense, but it's the behaviour matches beautifully the distribution of those sensors in the mouth and the beak.
You in that chapter, you write about this this orange and black bird in New Guinea turns out to be one of the world's first distasteful birds.
Yep. I mean, this is a real surprise. I mean, everybody knows that lots of insects are distasteful, either because they sting or because they exude some noxious substance. But the discovery that there were a small number of birds that were also distasteful came as a real shock about 20 or 30 years ago. And it happened in a very casual kind of way, as so many scientific discoveries do. And this researcher had been handling this bird, a pitu, in New Guinea, and after handling the bird, had touched or licked his finger and then noticed that his tongue had gone numb. And at the time, thought nothing of it. And then when it happened a second time, he thought, hang on, there's something going on here. And then later, when he caught one of these birds and was actually able to place one of its feathers on his tongue, the effect was kind of electric. And he and his supervisor realised that they were onto something absolutely novel. And so this is a bird that eats a particular kind of beetle, uses the poisons in those beetles to secrete a substance through the skin onto the feathers that makes the bird distasteful. That what he hasn't done, which if, as a scientist I would have been very keen to do, is to figure out how effective this is. So, you know, you could have easily taken one or two of this bird's feathers and wrapped them around a piece of meat and then presented them to a bird of prey to see whether they would have responded in the same way, which would have also told us how good the bird of prey's sense of taste is. But that hasn't been done yet, but it's kind of crying out to be done.
Yeah.
One of the interesting things when I was writing the book my editor, who was fantastic at Bloomsbury, he said, stop telling people all the stuff we don't know. They really want to know what we do know. And I said, hang on, as a scientist, I'm interested in what we don't know, because that's where the new ideas come from.
Mm. Let's go back to the phones. 801-585-WEST, again, the number to join us. Dan is with us in Salt Lake. Dan, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I was wondering about crows. I know that the family that they belong to, the corvids, are some of the most intelligent group of animals in the world. And I've seen footage, it was on Animal Planet or National Geographic Channel, of a crow playing with a kitten. And it looked like they both were enjoying it. And in regards to how intelligent they are, I was wondering, do they play with each other? Is it possible to, like, leave food out and maybe befriend crows, you know? Because I also know that they can recognize people's faces.
Yeah, that's a good question.
That is a great question. And corvids, as you say, are the most intelligent of birds. And, yes, they do have friendships, and they play. I mean, I studied magpies for 10 years when I first came to Sheffield. Huh. And I remember one winter when we had quite a lot of snow, a group of magpies were literally tobogganing down this little slope and just going round and round. And clearly, you know, why else would they do that? There was some pleasure in that. And also, if you've ever hand-reared a crow or a magpie, you know that they do have an incredible sense of fun. And you can see that in wild birds when they mob potential predators like a heron or a hawk or something like that. They'll run up to it and just tweak a feather and jump back out of the way. Okay, it's risky to interpret that behavior, but it does look as though they're just kind of teasing it and having fun.
Dan, thanks. 801-585-WEST, again, the number to join us. You talk about how there's been also, for some reason, it's been hard to accept that birds also have a sense of smell. What was really interesting to me about this part of the book was this idea that there is an olfactory landscape in the sea. And this is the thing that an albatross or seabirds kind of detect. Talk about that, if you would.
Sure. Mariners have known for a long time that things like albatrosses and shearwaters are incredibly good at finding food. And there are stories going back, you know, a couple of hundred years where somebody is in a boat, it's foggy, and there are no birds in sight, and they cut up a bit of shark liver or whale liver and throw it onto the sea. And within 2 minutes, albatrosses and shearwaters have appeared out of nowhere. And so there was very good circumstantial evidence that these birds could smell this little bit of food that was thrown onto the sea. And then a female researcher called Gabby Nevitt in North America became interested in trying to understand how these albatrosses did this and repeated those kind of experiments and confirmed that, yes, these birds clearly do have a very good sense of smell. But then she met an atmospheric scientist who was telling her about a particular substance which is of interest to those who are concerned with global warming. And this substance is a kind of byproduct, an aerial byproduct of when plankton are eaten by fish. So the plankton are near the surface, they're munched up by fish, and the bits and pieces just let off a little bit of gas. And she did some experiments artificially releasing this stuff called DMS, and found that albatrosses were incredibly good at using this. And she recognized that instead of it being a featureless ocean, the ocean actually just must be a kind of mesh of plumes of these kind of substances coming off areas of the ocean where fish and other organisms have been foraging. In other words, an olfactory seascape.
Yeah. Of course, the champion, it seems, of smell, or one of them anyway, is the kiwi.
Yeah, that's my champion as well. When I was writing the book, I went to New Zealand to meet up with a colleague of mine who studies kiwis, and we were catching kiwis to replace the batteries in their radio transmitters. So having the opportunity both to catch kiwis and to have them in my hand, or rather in my lap, was absolutely wonderful. And then watching them at night through infrared scopes is just fantastic. And there are some experiments that demonstrate their sense of smell that go back to the 60s. And in fact, the experiments were almost redundant. So the researcher would go into the aviary where the kiwis were with a bucket with some bits of meat at the bottom of the bucket covered with, you know, 15 or 20 centimetres of soil. And the idea was to see whether the kiwi could probe and find the meat. But in fact, a lot of the experiments never got that far because the kiwi could always tell which bucket the meat was in anyway before the experimenter had set it up. So good was their sense of smell.
Wow.
And I think if I lived in New Zealand, that's what I'd focus my efforts on. You know, just kiwis are unbelievable.
You know, you've studied birds all around the world, as you say in the book, but the bird you keep coming back to is the guillemot. Are you headed back to Wales this summer, or have you already been?
I've been, and yeah, it's still my favourite place. As I say, this year was my 40th field season. I'm not sure I'll do another 40, but guillemots are great because they are so social. And when you've studied them for as long as I have, you get to know them in a very intimate kind of way. And so, you know, watching their behaviour is always a thrill.
What kind of reaction are you getting to the book now? Finally, I mean, are you pleased? People are having a sort of broader sense of the bird?
Absolutely. The reviews have been great. People have liked it and been very complimentary, so that's been fantastic. But what I would really like to see happen is that people like me, who are behavioural ecologists, embrace some of this sensory physiology to broaden the scope of what they're doing, because I'm sure that will enrich their understanding of how a bird operates in the real world.
Tim Burkhead. His book is Bird Sense, What It's Like to Be a Bird. He joined us today from the BBC Radio Studios in Sheffield, England. Tim Burkhead, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Our thanks and best wishes to Matthew Martin. He's leaving us, going to work at Al Jazeera in Washington. Technical direction from Mike Anderson, the program produced by Lane Clark and Benjamin Bombard and Doug Fabrizio.